The E-Commerce Fuel Podcast is brought to you by OneClick Upsell, the most popular, largest upsell app in the Shopify marketplace, trusted by over 11,000 users, over 1,900 of those big spending Shopify Plus stores, and they've generated over $200 million in revenue for the merchants that use them. And you may be thinking, oh, hey, Andrew, I've heard of OneClick Upsell. I know these guys, but do you really? Do you know what they've rolled out recently? They've got some cool new stuff. For their pre-purchase and their post-purchase upsells, you can now select from multiple different offers to present your customers. So instead of having them just have to pick from one single thing, you can give them the option to pick from multiple upsells, which helps and has proven to increase the number of people who actually take you up on those upsells. So if you're not using upsells in your store, it's an amazingly easy, fast way to increase your average order value and your revenues. So check them out at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the E-Commerce Fuel Podcast, a show dedicated to helping 7- and 8-figure brand owners build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And today on the show, a little bit of an enigma, someone who I have seen kind of around Twitter. I tried to find his website, but I couldn't find one. And so eventually I just DM'd him and said, hey, I would love to get to know you better. You seem to pop up in conversations with a lot of smart entrepreneurs about paid traffic. Would you be willing to come on and kind of just share everything that you know? And very graciously, David Herman agreed to come on. And I can't wait. We're going to be talking about paid traffic. We're going to be talking about kind of what's going on that landscape. Probably touch on some non-e-commerce, non-paid traffic things. Talk a little bit about homelessness, which is totally not something we normally talk about on the show. And a bunch of other things, but we're going to start with car chases. David, welcome, man. Good to have you.
Hello.
Glad to be here. You ever started a podcast conversation with your favorite car chases before?
No, but I'm here for it.
Well, you love car chases, though. What is where did this love originate?
I think it's just the element of surprise that you're watching something live. I mean, you have no clue as to what's going to happen. And I mean, yes, it could be bad things that will happen, but you know, we've watched them. They're pretty much a daily occurrence in Los Angeles. And it started, honestly, at a really old job. I bought a police scanner online before they became illegal, the original police scanners. And I just started to learn all of the different police signals and understand like their lingo. And I just became addicted to having it on in the background when I was working and just like, oh, you know, there's a to, you know, whatever, some code. And you're like, oh, you Google it and figure out what it is. And like, this is actually getting good. And then you'd start to watch and see like what news station picks it up. And they'd only pick it up once they can deem it's worthy enough to have a helicopter follow. So I think it's just like the whole production of police chases in Los Angeles. And then the utter ridiculousness of them. The other day, somebody had stolen a golf cart and was on the freeway in a golf cart getting 9 squad cars chasing, like, you know, 20 miles an hour. And you just like, what? It's just ridiculous. So I think that's why I enjoy them.
That's awesome. So what's your, I mean, when I think about, I'm not aficionado like you are, but when I think of car chases, especially when I think of LA car chases, you know, OJ Simpson is immediately comes to mind. Is that is that your favorite live car chase?
Oh no. There's one that tops it. A woman stole a Winnebago camper with her dog. You can go on YouTube and I guarantee everyone that's listening to this will stop and go watch it. It's just type in Winnebago police chase and you will be transfixed for an hour and 15 minutes watching this. And I can assure you nothing like bad happens. Like there are things that happen. You're like, your job will be dropped. It's better than any movie, I swear. So
last question, and then we'll actually get on to things that probably matter a little bit more, but are maybe not quite as fun. You have to pick one getaway vehicle. Can't be a motorcycle. If you got a motorcycle, that's kind of an unfair fight. You have to pick one car to be in for a LA freeway chase. What are you driving? What are you behind the wheel of?
A 2003 Toyota Camry.
Okay. Wow. That was not what I was expecting. Okay. You got to explain further, please.
Because it's one of the most indestructible cars with really good gas mileage.
Do you think you're going to be able to go for like 400 miles? Why the gas mileage? I was thinking you were going to say like, hey, give me like a Shelby GT, you know, 800.
So the best thing about police chases is you need to blend into the traffic. And like, think the 2002, 2003 Toyota Camry is like one of the most like bought cars. And every time there's somebody in a police chase with a Camry, they usually last the longest because those things can just get beat up and continue. So that's why I'm thinking, and they get 22 to 25 miles per gallon. And, you're not stuck on the electric engines where it's going to just kind of putter out after a little bit. So yeah, the early 2000s Toyota Camry.
I that is one of the best answers I could have not anticipated, because it's completely different what I was expecting. So David, before we actually get into the real thing of the paid traffic, I got one more kind of meta question here. What's your philosophy about clients? Because like I mentioned at the top, you don't have a website, which is just kind of unheard of in this day and age for someone who has an agency. But obviously you've got a great reputation, heard about you through the grapevine. How do you think about clients and working with clients and acquisition and your presence online? Talk about that a little bit, because I think it's interesting.
Yeah, I think I take definitely an interesting perspective on it. I've worked with a couple of clients for a very long time. I prefer to go deeper versus wider on clients. And it's really, I think, I become friends with who I work with at the end of the day. Like some of the brands that I'm with, like I'm not just doing their paid media. I'm doing their creative strategy. I'm helping on coming up with the financial numbers with them. I'm, working even inventory and helping on organic social. Like we kind of, I guess, just kind of go just really deep. And I truly think like there's media buyer agencies that you can hire that generally are, just going to give you that, right? Hey, we're good at, paid traffic and that's it. And I think I have a lot to offer because I've been in marketing for almost 15 years now and have been doing this pre-social media. And I just like to just kind of help in all regards. And I've worked with brands that have just scaled really high and grown really fast. And I've worked with brands that are just getting started. And I think there's unique perspectives in both regards, and helping founders just kind of figure it out and, hey, let's hire this person to do this, or hey, let's do this, or hey, we're seeing this on this side, we should consider that, and kind of being okay to, I don't want to say it's like scope creep. I never consider anything scope creep to me, because again, we're being paid to help you on all fronts. And I think like all sides help each other. And so for me, that's what we do. Like we're not afraid to go, hey, yeah, we'll jump on a call and try to help figure that out. Or, hey, I actually want to learn more about that. Let's jump into Zoom and talk through it. So I think that's something that's kind of how I've always looked at it.
I love that. I think that's super cool. What's the longest you've worked with a client for?
I think 8 years. It's about 8 years.
Okay.
So
I love the approach and the word of mouth. I mean, it's the best way to advertise. So
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's get into it with paid traffic. Maybe we can kick it off. I'd love to hear your lay of the land. Like, where are we with online spend now for DTC? And maybe we can focus on Facebook, Google, and TikTok, although feel free to put in other things. But we're, recording this late 2023, the world of paid spend and attention online has changed a lot, even in the last couple of years. So yeah, give us the lay of the land, if you would. And what are you seeing out there in terms of trends?
Yeah, I think the biggest trends are, honestly, it's automation is becoming something that is really kind of taken over, especially the top three that you mentioned. It seems that these platforms are really trying to get media buyers out of the weeds of, day trading and, doing all the stuff that all of us have kind of done over the years, and to say, hey, let us take care of it and just focus on, focus on your creative and things like that. And I think that, looking at year over year to see kind of how we are this year, where, Meta has their Advantage Plus fully rolled out, Google has, their wonderful Performance Max rolled out, and TikTok now has their automated campaign optimization campaigns, smart campaigns. It seems to be that's just where the systems are going, but there's almost like a fight going on between, I think, savvy media buyers and these platforms that are sort of going like, hey, we still want to do our manual bids, or we still want to do, our old lookalikes and things like that. And, I would say that it's chaotic in a way right now because of the philosophies are so different, but there are some nuances, I think, that should, I don't want to say like you should do, but we're seeing generally that the more you can listen and opt in for what these platforms are telling you to do, Meta specifically and TikTok, it's benefiting you. And by what that I mean is, you know, the push for Meta shops, the push for TikTok shops, these in-app checkouts. You know, I've got brands that I run that we're spending the most money we've ever spent. And I'm saying these are brands that have been around for a long time. And we're spending the most money we've ever spent, and we're having our best CPAs ever because we've been implementing TikTok shops and Meta shops. And it's not like it's spending all of the money on these platforms, but it's at least it's giving an opportunity to figure out where to go. And from a marketing perspective, being more savvy and understanding how to use and manipulate your product feeds for shops is, I think, one of the better tactics to go into any type of holiday season, and optimizing in shops around, you know, your high AOV and things like that. That's really, to me, the state of where we're at, is just listening to what the platforms are doing and telling you, and then figuring out how that works best for your brand, and then trying to find that white space where you can potentially find some small wins, because ultimately I think it's making up for a lot.
Yeah, and I'm going to really showcase my naivety here, but Meta shops, TikTok shops, in-platform, I haven't experienced these, in-platform purchasing for, you don't have to leave Meta, you don't have to leave TikTok to actually purchase, so just kind of on-platform sites. What are you seeing those work pretty universally across a lot of brands? Like, what is the, or do you have to get some things right, or is it, does the fit have to be right?
Yeah, Meta shops across at least the brands that I have visibility in, or the brands that I talk to on a daily basis, pretty much are all finding them working pretty dang well. And by that, I mean that they have been able to figure out, you know, what types of products work best in them. Because if you just put up like a product catalog and don't have any consideration and just run traffic to a homepage, Meta is always going to optimize for your lowest AOV, because it's like, okay, I know I can get whatever. And so it's building these collection pages similarly to Shopify, right? Driving traffic to them. TikTok shops is a little bit different. TikTok shops is a very, very hit or miss. But if you have the right product that works for a TikTok audience, and I think, I mean, we've been in marketing for as long as ever, right? It's like, you can market anything if you know how to do it right. But with TikTok shops, what I've identified was the more you can drive from non-product, so non-brand accounts, and more from like affiliates. So like having, you know, Joe Schmo post about you and then running your TikTok shops to it. That to me has been working the best. And so what we've been doing is signing up creators and then giving them a percentage of what they drive as their payment. And it's really just building affiliates on TikTok. And that seems to be what's the most stable and growth, and where, I don't know if you've logged on TikTok, but it's pretty much every other post is a TikTok shops post these days. And so, you know, if it's working, I just kind of stick with it and go. So yeah, that's kind of how they are.
What is it that makes them work better than, and you touched on it a little bit there, but I don't think I fully followed your logic. What is it that makes it better than just going to your own website? Because I mean, arguably you've got your best copy and images and your full functionality is there. So why is it less friction? Is it in platform payment? What is it that makes?
Yeah, it's, I think one of the biggest reasons is it's first party data for Meta and for TikTok that hasn't been stripped by Apple, right? It's people are providing their data to Meta, and they're not having to go to Shopify to check out. It's straight through Meta. And that the system is actually able to optimize off of that. And the bigger you go and the more you get into it, the better it gets. And, you know, I think a lot of people don't tend to trust Meta or TikTok or Google on their attribution these days, and rightfully so. But when it comes to the Meta shops, you can line it up one for one within Shopify. Like, the data is there for you to line up, and it's accurate. And so me and a few others have really pushed at least Meta to be more transparent with the data, like conversion rates, traffic, how much traffic is coming to these. And they've been really actually listening to us, and they've been putting a lot more insights into their commerce manager, which is kind of a bundled mess right now. But there is some really great takeaways. And where I think the best benefit of this is a variety of things. Number one, it allows you to actually go old school retargeting and build lookalikes off of that first party data. And so far in all of my tests, I found that it's some of the best data to be running lookalikes off of. And then two, it actually will give you insights from an organic perspective, like, because your shops is both organic and paid, and you can actually see, hey, did an organic post drive sales, and actually take those posts and build off those, right? And Meta, even so far as you can tag, you can have brands or influencers tag your posts on Instagram as the shops, and you can drive it that way too. And so there's just a lot of more visibility. And I think Meta has done actually, I'm not really the one to say Meta does a lot of great things, but in regards to Meta shops, I think they built a great product. There's still a lot of issues with it. TikTok shops is still very new, and there's still quite a bit of functionality and difficulty in getting access to it. But Aaron, they're both just, they seem to be working a lot better than just the standard web.
Interesting. How do you think, do you have any thoughts on how Google ties into all this? Like, obviously, they're still massive 500-pound gorilla in terms of search, and they've got product feeds and ads and things, but they don't really have a commerce. I mean, Amazon, of course, enables commerce. Facebook and TikTok right now are. Do you think, any thoughts on how this like plays out for Google, or if they make a move here?
I think that Google is the hardest one to know what's going on, because I feel like everything they've done is completely create a closed garden with Performance Max. My personal thinking with Google is I think they saw the antitrust stuff coming down the pipeline, and they've just been really careful on doing anything innovative. And I don't personally see them doing, I mean, I think they have every right to do a Google Shops type activity, but I don't know, with the state of GA4 and how long that took to come out and what we got, I'm just not super hopeful that they could execute on something that wouldn't be really, really confusing to figure out for people. Frankly, I think that their benefit is always going to be search, as long as it's relevant, right, with Google. But outside that, like, you know, even shopping campaigns haven't been doing nearly as well over the past few months as they have over the past couple of years. And, you know, you're seeing the opposite with Meta. You know, I work with some legacy brands that, you know, they were make or break on Google, and their Google numbers are just down, but their Facebook numbers are up, and that's what's actually keeping them up. It's kind of weird to see what's been happening. So you'll get a sense. I'm not a huge Google guy myself. I do a lot with Google for a few legacy brands because I have, but I try not to take on Google because it actually causes me way too much anxiety to try to figure it out because it's changing so much.
What do you think? I mean, you mentioned at the very top that all of the platforms, or most of the platforms, are making trying to take all of the opening up the hood and getting your wrenches out, so to speak, and trying to take that away, and just it's to simplify things. Here's the media, here's some headlines, make it much more approachable for someone who doesn't have the background as a mechanic, you know, to keep the analogy going. Where does it make sense? Like, where does that make sense? Like, where are you going to probably see results that are just as good or almost as good with that approach? And where does it make sense still on the different platforms to pop the hood, grab your socket wrenches, and really like change your own spark plugs in terms of fine tuning things? Do you have any preferences, like strong opinions there?
I think that Meta, I have seen enough to know if you're able to do and listen to what Meta is telling you to do, it generally works out in your favor. That's the one where, and I know that I'm probably gonna get a lot of criticism on this one, but I've seen this time and time again, and I'm not spending $1,000 a day. I'm talking spending some serious coin. And I have some brands that I've specifically for the year just said, you know what? I'm gonna listen to everything Meta says. Buy-in from the client says, all right, let's try it. And our numbers have never been better. And Google is really the only one where we've listened to what Google tells us to do, and it's steered us in the wrong direction. And, you know, I've had to call my buddy, I think, I don't know if William Harris, if you know William Harris, he's a good friend of mine. He's works for, runs an agency out of Minneapolis. Like, I routinely call him and go, hey, you guys are like Google guys. Like, what am I missing here? They go, oh, you know, there's this button they just randomly added that you have to go uncheck and then you're fine. You're like, it feels just like it's constantly manipulating you on the Google front versus everywhere else. So that's kind of like my take on that.
What areas of opportunity do you see? I mean, I feel like so much of the internet history has been opportunity opens up, you hop in, you try to get as much, you know, you try to milk the nascent opportunity or like the very fertile fields as long as possible, you know, until they get saturated and then you move on to the next field. Anything come to mind for you right now, even if it's not wildly scalable, right? Like, if you really need to grow an eight-figure brand, you're probably not going to be able to draw on the backs of one of these. But do you see any areas, beautiful, just lush green fields that maybe others aren't noticing that, even if limited in scale, are really interesting to you right now from a marketing perspective?
Honestly, it's probably TikTok Shops. It really is, because the level of actually building it and getting it going is really, it's not easy. And the more you can already have an affiliate platform lined up for you, the better you'll be. And I'm talking 8 cent cost per click to your shops. I'm talking under $1 CPM on an OCPM conversion campaign. I'm talking, 12 to 18% conversion rates if you can hit it just right. It's the Wild West right now on that front. And I've never seen it better. Furthermore, again, I'm going to keep harping on it, but Meta Shops, it really is like, I think people are just afraid, right? They don't necessarily like the idea of Meta owning the customer, but I just think that we're in an era where people want to shop however they're easiest, and we have to be everywhere, right? We have to be on Amazon. We have to be in Walmart.com. We have to be kind of in all these places the bigger you go, because your customers are just, a lot of customers will stick with certain platforms and only do it, right? Like some people will only do Shop Pay or at PayPal or whatever, right? And being able to have everything nowadays is really kind of how you have to be. And I think that same thing goes for growth, like making sure, hey, if Meta has this, let's optimize for what they're saying, because their data is telling them this. And if I can give that system more data, the better overall I'm going to be. And so I have a brand, and I'll just tell you a quick story. Year over year, we've increased spend by a little over 2,000% year over year. And our CPA year over year is less than last year. So we decreased the CPA by 36%. We increased spend by 2,000%. And I did all this simply because I run Web Plus Shop campaigns for each product vertical. And I update the creative once a week with 3 to 4 new ads, and then kill whatever is fiddling and going down. And I keep it as consistent as that. And it's turnkey. Like it's the most stable account I run. And it's because the founder has bought into this, and we have 4 different creative agencies that provide us creative. And, one brand, we'll figure out like, hey, this SKU or this product's working the best. Let's go all in on that until it stops working, and then let's switch it up again. And the results are just telling. And these are founders that have never hit even $1 million a month marks and are consistently doing it and going like, we need to have bigger warehouses. We need to go harder. And it's really like, I can't speak to it enough. Like the Wild West is out there, but there's too many of these platforms telling you, hey, do this. We lost the data. This is the way to get the data back. Go for it.
Interesting. My next question here, I have less conviction in this thesis now than I did when we started our conversation based on some of the things you're saying, but I'm still going to throw it out there anyway. So I have this philosophy and this kind of working hypothesis on the size of brands, and that if you look at the landscape, like big tech is entrenched everywhere, right? Like you just have just these 3 or 4 players that just kind of have it by a chokehold on the internet. And because they have quasi or non-quasi, just straight up monopoly power, you're going to see fewer opportunities to scale attention cheaply. Like, you mentioned TikTok Shops and things like that, and that's kind of a newer one. But largely, you have less competition, so there's less of those green fields we talked about to arbitrage attention. And so increasingly, you have to earn it more so the old-fashioned way, through great product, through great branding, through great, less just blasting the message and more like having a great message or a great product. And so you're going to build businesses that do get built that way, and do it and earn it more, they're going to have more loyalty. But we're going to be entering an era of smaller, more durable brands, where brands that, you'll still have brands that just scale really quickly, but the number of those that you grow to 100 million in 3 or 4 years through just really good paid are going to go down. So, but then the businesses that do exist are going to be more connected to the owners, are probably going to be they're stronger and more durable because they've earned it the old fashioned way. So when you hear that, and again, I come from an area of having almost no media buying paid traffic. That's your bread and butter.
Yeah.
Where does that sound like maybe I've got it right? Or where does that just sound totally off base or either end of the spectrum?
I think it's a mix of both. I've had the fortune to work with some of the biggest D2C brands. I've been at the helm of some of the top dogs. I've watched them either get acquired by, you know, some massive holding companies. And I've also been at the other end where I've watched these businesses hemorrhage cash left and right. And you're just like, what are you doing? And so I really do think that the days of sort of disruption, right? Well, yeah, like we're the Uber of X, or we're the better version of, you know, Charmin or whatever it may be. I think that there really does need to be a value differentiator of that product. And like, I've worked with a couple brands over the past few years that I think are definitely on their way to having that kind of sort of coveted, you know, higher echelon D2C, you know, revenue number that kind of puts them into sort of the zeitgeist or of everyone's mind, right? It's out there, but there's a difference in that they all have something unique about them that is not like anything else. And that's really where I think the biggest differences in between the two was, years ago, VC was funding literally anything that had a good idea. And now they're just like, hey, no, we're going to pull back and we're going to go better into like, hey, this is a unique product. But I think there's more bootstrapping happening and there's less of the plush cash coming in. And then it's proving yourself. And then once you hit a certain number, then maybe you get some funding and then go from there. But yeah, it's definitely like, you look at like Allbirds, right? It's a kind of classic, right? Like they've really struggled in sort of like kind of like their post IPO of like where to go. And I just think that there's not really a value differentiator there between them and another brand, right? You can't, sure, they help the environment, but I don't know if those are strong enough values now in 2023 as they were in say 2019, 2020, when that was really hip and cash was flush. So
let me ask one more question on that front. Have you seen acquisition prices, like your CPAs in general, go down over the last 2 years? Because I think that's kind of like the standard narrative people say. But I mean, for you, for example, you talked about that client that, you know, the increased spend 2,000% and you're actually saw a decrease in your cost of acquisition. So, but if you had to average it across the board for someone like yourself, who's doing this carefully thinking and not just throwing money into the void and seeing what works or mostly doesn't, in general, have you seen acquisition costs go up the last 2 years?
I've seen it go up, but not as significantly as I guess I would say it's not been as impactful, again, a negative impact for the business as many would think, because often we're seeing a higher increase in AOV because we've increased costs, right? So we've increased the cost of the products by $5, $10. So naturally our CPAs climb. I have not seen to the level of like chaotic increases that some people claim. Sure, it's not the same as 2016, but that's a reality. But I have not seen, if you're just comparing COVID numbers, yes, it's gone up since 2020, but not over like the last year to two years. The brands that are spending and continuing to increase in spend all have one thing in common, right? They have really, really, really good margins and they're able to kind of withstand a lot of that because they were already playing in an area of growth that allowed them to make mistakes and try things and do things. It's the brands that were just barely eking by that just can't do it anymore. And that's, I think, the big difference now.
Hey, Andrew here with a little aside. If you're listening, you're obviously interested in e-commerce. And so I want to make sure you know about our private community for 7- and 8-figure e-commerce brands at e-commerce fuel. And the secret sauce, like you might guess, is it's limited to people who own stores, who are in the trenches, practitioners doing this stuff. It's a very curated community, which has three big benefits. First, it means everyone inside can help get fast on-point answers to your most important questions. If you're trying to decide if SMS is a tool worth rolling out, if you just got suspended on Amazon, if you're trying to hire a director of e-commerce, these are all things that either people have experience with or have gone through in the forums. And if you post and ask questions, you'll get answers within hours, sometimes even minutes, as well as being able to tap into close to a decade of archived discussions. So you get a lot of insights, fast answers to pressing questions. You get to plug into an amazing network of over 1,100 experienced e-commerce entrepreneurs. So you can reach out to people if If you're in e-commerce fuel, our members are incredibly giving and generous. And so if you want to reach out to someone with expertise, oftentimes we'd be happy to share what they know. If you're, you know, traveling, hopefully when traveling is a common thing again, a lot of our members would hit in the city, you know, DC, Dallas, Sydney, Australia, you know, London, wherever it is, and be able to have someone on the ground you can connect with or maybe grab a beer with. It's an amazing network. And then finally, we've got a huge user-generated review library with over 10,000 reviews on agencies, software, e-commerce software that you can tap into to avoid costly hiring and software mistakes. Nothing is worse than spending 3 months with an agency to onboard only to find out that a bunch of people already tried them and they were horrible and they wasted a bunch of your money and your life. So those are the kind of things you can avoid tapping into the unbiased reviews and experiences of our members with our software directory. So if any of this sounds interesting to you, you should join us at ecommercefuel.com. You can learn more. You can apply for membership there. We also have a 5x ROI guarantee. If you own a 7 or 8 figure brand and your membership fees for our community don't pay for themselves at least 5 times over the course of the first year, we'll refund it completely as well as send you $1,000 just for the wasted time. So ecommercefuel.com, check it out. We'd love to have you apply and potentially join the community. All right. Back to the discussion.
When you think about KPIs for traffic, how you measure it, and again, coming from someone who's not a paid traffic aficionado, but that being said, you know, I feel like this pops up on Twitter all the time, like, hey, you know, MER is the best, or average cost of sale, or you know, what's the ratios that you look at? And they're just gauges, different gauges, like a car is different gauges. But do you have one or two that you rely on the most and that you think are the most accurate? How do you think about measuring performance in terms of all those different metrics?
Yeah, I mean, the sexy one these days is contribution margin, right? And I think that we've got some brands that we work with that are just absolutely obsessed with their contribution margin percentage. And that's what their North Star is. And then I've got a couple other brands that MER is the only thing they focus on, right? It's, hey, as long as we're here, and they all kind of fall in the same general area. The big thing that we've seen as a shift over like the past few years is actually measuring Shopify or whatever e-commerce platform they're on and Amazon together. There's been a massive shift in the sort of like, you know what? We don't know where this traffic is going. They're probably showing up somewhere. So let's just measure it all together. And I think that's been the biggest unlock for a lot of brands has been just to say, you know what? They're going to buy on Amazon regardless. So let's just build that into our model and go from there. And then, you know, another one that we look at is really just the overall LTV of the brand and kind of measuring like, hey, you know, what products are actually driving a lifetime total value of a customer? Like which ones are driving more second purchases and third purchases? We, on one of the brands we uncovered by just looking at our LTV that when we sell one shoe to this one specific shoe, for example, like you will see that somebody would come back and buy, you know, the next, like within a week or two, right? And it's like, it's just like an interesting perspective of like, hey, like people are buying these things way quicker than maybe you think. And, you know, there's some surprising nuggets in there that sort of like, I guess, sort of stand out to make you go, hey, maybe this should be something that we focus on more. So yeah, that's sort of, I think, kind of generally the way that I look at that.
Big theme from the top already is that a lot of the complexity in setting up ad campaigns is disappearing, and a lot of the platforms are streamlining that. So I'm asking this to someone who runs a digital marketing agency, especially on the paid side, but do you feel like a lot of the ad buyers and the media agencies are going to disappear? Not disappear is the wrong word, but is it going to shift from, hey, being a media buyer to being a creative agency first and foremost? Like you see that if you have a paid traffic agency, like is that going to be a mandatory shift, that a pivot that most people are going to have to make in the next 2 or 3 years?
I think that unfortunately it's becoming such a strong part of our jobs these days to do the creative strategy. I know for me, I spend more time focusing on creative than anything else these days. I have a film background. I went to film school. So cool. I think for me, it's I naturally have an inclination of moving into that area, you know, but I've hired somebody that literally just helps me write creative briefs now because I'm spending so much time conceptualizing ideas for clients. And I don't make the content because it being able to media buy and create content, just it's too much. But, you know, we're working with more and more editors and things like that. And it's becoming an aspect of this that you need to have. And it's hard. It's hard for a lot of people because I think media buyers generally were more data driven than they were creative. And it's now really like you have to be creative. And so having those days where you're just creative, and I've really shifted how I work. Like I have, you know, 1 or 2 days a week that I'm just creative. That's it. I don't do anything analytical. I don't even look at the ad accounts. I just think and get into my head of like how I would position this. That might be, you know, researching, looking at our ad comments, to like looking at the trends and things like that, going on Reddit or whatever it may be to see reviews. That's really where I think the difference has been over the past few years is on that front. But yes, creative is the biggest needle you're going to have, and being able to know how to measure it and know how to sort of kind of conceptualizing new ideas, knowing that you're going to probably bat 180 to 200, if that, and that needs to be your win and be okay with that. That's something I've learned in this game, is like not being too hard on yourself if this awesome idea you had fails, because it's probably going to fail, but it's just executing. And also I'll add one last thing to that of like, you know, I think a lot of people get super overwhelmed with how much creative they need to execute on. And that brand I mentioned earlier that I've scaled so hard on, whenever I have an idea, I actually will create the concept in Canva myself. I'm not paying charging for that. And I'll just put a headline over a static image headline to test the idea. And I'll just get a gauge. I'll spend like $50 and I'll just get a gauge. Like how is the audience responding to this? Oh, they're responding to it really well. Okay. Now I got this concept. Now I'm going to go make a ton more versions of this and actually get the teams, creative teams, to go and execute. That's been our biggest unlock. That's really been it. And I live in Canva. Like I've got the same standard, you know, format that I take across this brand. I literally PNG the product, change the headline, go. And we uncovered so many new ideas based on that, that then I go back to the creative team and say, hey, this really worked. I need you guys to take this headline and go conceptualize how a video would do with this. And then they just go, come back to me, and they go, all right, we found one that works. Let's scale it. And we go. So
that's super smart, because then you're not wasting all of that time putting out super polished versions of just, you know, little turds really that aren't going to do very well. You can test them.
Exactly.
That's brilliant.
And I think it's harder for the bigger the brand you get, the more it's difficult to do this. And I've encountered that, and I get this all the time, right? Hey, I'm so-and-so at, you know, $150 million brand, and, you know, we can't do that. We, you know, like, well, unfortunately, that's where we're heading. Like I don't know if you saw, and I don't know, this might be dating this podcast, but with Taylor Swift, you know, I don't know if you saw that the Kelsey or whatever, the football player she's dating, he was wearing a jacket. And the e-commerce brand literally changed the name of the jacket right as he walked in. They went on the website and they changed the jacket to the 1989 edition. And like instant clicks, because it's just so relevant. But that's what we're heading to. And unless you're able to be nimble enough continuing this conversation around not being so stuck in the weeds, but being nimble enough to make mistakes, try ideas, and keep moving forward, obviously making it sure that legal is not going to, you're not going to get in trouble, but you know, it's okay to try to make mistakes along the way. And maybe the content doesn't look as good, but hey, if we learn something from it, we learned, you know?
Yeah. How do you, when you're talking about media, so what's the media team look like for you? Is it people you've hired? Is it some good agencies? And I'm asking this too, from the perspective of if there's someone out there who wants to kind of DIY this, they want to go in, they're comfortable testing some of these things, or maybe they're a smaller brand, they can't afford a media buying agency. What is that? How can they find a great creative side that can take these basic ideas and bring them to life, either visually, you know, for the photograph, or especially on the video side? So how does that look?
Yeah.
Who are those people you're interfacing with on that side?
I work with a guy I actually kind of helped got going during COVID. He had been laid off his job and kind of gone through a little bit of difficulty. And so I just came in, I said, hey, I need you to help me in this regard. And so he was able to kind of pick it up real quick and take off. and he focuses on creator content, right? And then I have another person who I work with that is basically in Hollywood, does script writing, does all that stuff, and, you know, had time on their hands to write me stuff. And it's really, for me, it's kind of figuring out who works the best and kind of go from there. And like the guy that can create content for me, that's commercials that would be on TV, that can get me commercials at cheaper rates, I'm not going to use him for everything because he's better at the high end production and really not great at the lower end production, and vice versa. And so I think it's important to have a mix of people in the back of your pocket that you can kind of rely on and help you get whatever it is you need. And I have probably 12 different editors that I work with on a given month, and I'll test them. And if they can't meet that project, I'll move on to somebody else. And, you know, I've got one editor I've worked with now for a couple of years that just is consistently gets me exactly what I need, understands how I work, and kind of takes criticism very well. And so it really is different for everybody. But the area that has been the biggest impact to the business is making sure that you're able to build creative briefs for your brands. It can be as simple as making sure your content is organized. I see this all the time. There's just content everywhere. Nothing is, you know, built out. There's no rhyme or reason as to the naming conventions. I will tell anybody, build your warehouse of creative. Like, make sure you've got your ad names on them and you're all set that way. Because the more you can be streamlined there, the better your editors are going to be, because they're able to actually find the things that they need.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. What you mentioned when I was kind of digging some, well, you didn't mention this, but when I was stalking you in preparation for this call, you're really good at creating content that pushes ROI, which I think we've kind of talked a little bit about. But another thing you mentioned was that you are great at building authentic audiences for brands. That's like kind of one of your superpowers. Talk a little bit about that. What do you mean by that, and how do you do that?
Yeah, I think, again, that riches are in the niches, right? And the more you can empower communities to be all in on your brand, the better it's going to be the scale. I'll go back to mentioning that brand that I've scaled so hard. You know, they sold traditionally one item to one customer. And I went and dug into their customer reviews, and I started to encounter that another subset of people were really all over the brand. And I was like, that's interesting, but we've never pushed ads. So we've completely flipped the switch, and we went all in on this other audience. Sure enough, click-through rates increased substantially, conversion rate increased more, and we built an entire new demographic of people that we were able to scale with. What's funny is if we go back to just the one category that I started with the brand, I would not have been able to scale the brand at all because they hit that saturation point. But then we unlocked such a massive other audience between our advertorial pages, our landing pages, and our ads to go a different route. And what's funny is it all started with static ads. Like, it was just headline testing against a hidden product page. Like, I literally took the product that we had. I hid the product, a new product. I changed the name of the product to something else. I messaged, I wasn't lying. I was messing. I added new comments. I changed the images on it. It was hidden from the site. It was only for paid. And I tested it in a week, and it doubled our conversion rate. And it's like, okay, let's go in. Let's go all in on that. And that's what I've traditionally tried to do for the brands that I work with. Because again, that's how you can unlock things. And I think people feel like they resonate. It's an offer at the end of the day, right? Like, and this is the time of year where I have more fun with it. Like, right? Like, I'm like, I'll create product demo or product like combos for like Black Friday and be like, this is the Christmas vacation bundle, or like whatever. Just like come up with random names and just hide them on the product pages and drive traffic to them. Cause like, you just try to go towards what people are thinking through at that time.
Love it. You tell me a little bit about being a part-time head of product for Northbeam. That sounds very interesting. You're getting to play with some cool stuff, and it ties into kind of a lot of what we're talking about. What have you been doing there, and like what do you feel like has been really, really effective in helping you on the paid side in terms of marketing?
I think, you know, Northbeam is a company that kind of came into a number of years ago, and it was actually Sean and Connor at the Ridge Wallet that turned me on. This was back in 2020, And I was had the fortune to actually get to work with those two guys, and they're just awesome dudes to work with. And you know, they lost a media buyer last minute and asked me to kind of come in and help until they could find somebody new. And they're like, "We're this Northbeam thing," and I just fell in love with it. I fell in love with it for a variety of reasons, because not just because it gave me some better visibility into things, but just overall, it helped me sort of connect the dots across the brand, like how Paid is impacting with everything else. And so Austin, the CEO, asked me to kind of come on board as a media buyer and be like, "Hey, like, you know what you need. Like, would you be interested in like running product for us?" And, you know, I was like, I don't have time for this. And so he's like, we can figure it out. We can work with your schedule. And so that's kind of how it happened. And it's allowed me to do a lot of things. But I think number one has been able to shape the front end of a platform to sort of kind of give me sort of like, hey, like, this is the dream of something that I'm looking for in a product. And we've really shaped the product to be kind of geared towards media buyers. And it's media buyers that are dictating how it looks, how it feels. And hey, you know, like, everybody's wanting certain things. And it's like, well, okay, let's add that. Or like customer journeys or orders pages and things like that, that it's more of like a robust version of kind of all these tools. And it was funny because I don't think it kind of got lost in this whole attribution platform sort of thing, but that was never really the original reason for this. It was kind of more of like, you're just de facto like D2C, you know, sort of like analytics tool that offers all these things. And then that just naturally happened as a result of iOS 14 loss. But it's actually grown me a lot because I'm able to talk with so many founders, so many media buyers, and then I get to sort of talk with them and see, hey, this is how they're doing things. Oh, I've never thought about that. Or, you know, it's made me very more well-rounded because I'm exposed to just so much more data. And then I also get to work with some pretty stellar engineers and even data scientists and talk through like, hey, you know, when it comes to sort of data warehouses and what we're sort of dealing with, you know, with conversion API on Meta or, you know, any of these things, like how important having clean data is. And I think that's really helped me as well, kind of play in that world and figure out like, hey, what kind of data should we pass back to Meta? What kind of data is important to have and all that kind of stuff. That all came as a result of working with Northbeam.
Are you using GA4 for anything? Like when you think about the data that you track, you got in Facebook, in Google, you've got Northbeam data. Are you using GA4 that much?
I use it. I actually like it. I actually don't mind it. If you can figure it out and understand what it is, I don't think it's a bad tool. It's just like it's not like you're not looking at it on the day to day because there's just that all of those levels of privacy issues. So typically how I work is I use Northbeam as sort of like my signal. And then I verify that between Meta or, you know, TikTok or whatever, and then GA4. And I just kind of look across the board. And, you know, with attribution, there's half the time it's just guessing anyway. And so what you're doing is just looking at the signal, because the signal moving in a positive or a negative direction. And, you know, it's allowed me to be able to sort of like have like a check, like, okay, well, last click has gone up, view through has gone down, and click has gone up. Okay, I'm going to go all in because Meta's optimizing for what I need. Or, you know, view through is shot through the roof, GA last click is down, Northbeam is showing one day click is down. Okay, I'm shutting this ad off because it's just all view through and it's not getting me what I need from an incrementalities perspective or whatever it may be. So that's kind of how I look at it.
Do you, for people who are still trying to wrap their head around GA4, I mean, you mentioned you're the first person who's been like, I don't mind it. And usually when I mention GA4, people, you can see their head kind of explode on camera with frustration. What is it that you... any tips for people who are still trying to figure out what in the heck Google was thinking and how to be able to use this?
Yeah. I mean, I think that you just have to forget everything you knew about the original Google Analytics and go into it with a fresh perspective. That's what I did. Honestly, like I knew Google Analytics like the back of my hand. I've been in it since its inception, basically. And so I just went into GA4 with a fresh mind. I said, look, like, I'm going to set up dashboards the best way I can. I'm still uncovering things that I don't know, right? Every day it's something new. I have personal dashboards set up for certain things, like landing pages for specific conversion events and things like that that I'm looking at. I just think it's easier from that perspective to get and build those things around dashboards. I also have leaned into a few people on Twitter that are experts on GA4 that I've just sat down and talked with. I know there's a I'm sure, you know, there's a lot of these groups out there that have people that I just encourage people if they can find someone to talk to or just go on YouTube. I'm on YouTube all the time typing in GA4 hacks for this. Because again, I don't have time to learn everything about it. I'd rather just see how someone's doing it and go copy it, because it's honestly, that's, I just need to get the data quicker. But the thing that I've liked the most has been sort of just the way that I can access dashboards in the way that it is and look at it from, because it's more of an events-based now versus session-based. And I think that looking at event-based is just a different perspective, and it just gives me a more well-rounded. Again, it's not as good as Google Analytics, but I know that we're in a privacy era where this is just naturally going to happen, and it's the best it's going to be. And I just got to keep a positive mind about it, because there's no going back. So I may as well just embrace it.
I'm going to take maybe one of the hardest right turns I've had on the podcast here and go from Google Analytics 4 to homelessness in Los Angeles. How do you think about that with your neighborhood?
Yeah, I think it's having compassion for just the downtrodden and sort of trying to love others as you want to be loved yourself in a way. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think that I just always have had a philosophy of, hey, am I doing enough, or am I just complaining about a solution? And for me, I would drive through Los Angeles and just see this growing ever homeless population growing, and everyone grumbles about it. It's like, someone's got to do something, right? And it's like, well, you know, I'm a man of faith, and as a Christian, I just felt calling to help homeless in a way. And I just went and started to actually just have conversations with people, even the scariest looking people I just kind of have conversations with. And, you know, the reality is you have to go in your mind that you're not going to be able to help the majority of those people. You're just not, right? They need mental health. They need a lot of things. But it was interesting because, you know, where I live, we have a thing called homeless court. And what it is it's a compassionate way of getting those people help. They essentially go in front of a local government, and they are told to show up, and they get quote unquote sentenced to whatever it may be. It's never prison. It's not anything like that. It's like, hey, you know, we think that you need this sort of, you're going to go to this housing project. They're going to help you with this, this, and this. Do you accept those terms? Yes. Right. Because at the end of the day, there's still laws in place. You can't forcefully take people off the streets. It's not legal. But it's all about finding ways to have compassion and be okay with them saying no, but then having the law step in and be like, no, you're not going to be able to do that type of activity in a playground or by a school, and protect those spaces. And, you know, there's areas. I live in Los Angeles in a suburb called Redondo Beach. You know, LA is a whole different ballgame, 60,000+ homeless people. But, you know, my philosophy is I'm not going to solve homeless, but I can at least impact a few people along the way. And so that's always been my approach. And is it right? I don't know. I've personally paid for people to stay in hotels until I can help them. But once you've experienced how to help somebody that has encountered homelessness, you realize how difficult the system is to get them help. And then you start having more compassion for, okay, this is actually really hard. Oh, they don't have a birth certificate or a license. It's almost impossible to get them that help, right? And so it's just exposing you to a whole different world out there, and kind of like not just being so critical of a situation. I don't know. That's kind of how I look at it.
If you could change one or two of the ways in which California or Los Angeles, let's say you're mayor of Los Angeles or governor, and just have executive power to just, you know, will laws into place, what are one of the two things that you would change systemically?
I would say there's the 5150, which is sort of the law that you can hold somebody sort of against their will due to their welfare. Basically, like if they're harming themselves, right? The police can withhold somebody for, I think it's a 48 or 72 hour hold. I'm not entirely sure. I think it would be working on finding ways to make that a little bit easier to help. Because again, I was in New York this last week and I saw some pretty tragic, you know, people on drugs that clearly need the help, but they're not there. And I, my wife is a journalist and has encountered this as well, of like, you see people literally harming themselves, but if they don't physically see it happen, they can't help you. So I think it'd be really trying to find ways to loosen the 5150 hold a little bit longer to get people the help they need. But then I think in addition to that, I would enforce the rule of the law in a better way, where in most places, you can't just pop a tent on the side of the road. And I think that when cities allow it to happen for so long, it's almost like it's just going to continue and you need to enforce laws. And I think there's still compassion with that, but you need the services to back it up. And California in general has sort of had this thing where we spend so much money and we don't really get anywhere because there's too much bureaucracy in place. And I think that, you know, you need to define that in a certain way and streamline these things. It's just like in marketing, right? If there's too many cooks in the kitchen, there's too many people saying to do this and this, this, nothing gets done. And so it's sticking with an idea, this mentality and going. And I think you're actually seeing that within Los Angeles and California in general. The way that the governor has spoken more recently has been kind of about that. It's like, hey, we need to make this illegal to camp on the streets. Hey, LA is like, we need to build more housing and we're actually going to do it. There is a desire to do it. And so it's just a matter of, you know, spending the money and doing the thing that's uncomfortable, which is spending money on an issue that people generally are not fond of, right? So that's sort of my take on it.
No, I appreciate it, man. Thank you. It's a little, again, like I said, pretty hard right turn from yeah, Google and yeah. Facebook. But I think it's one of those things that's just becoming, I've noticed it more where we live. And I think you're right. I mean, I think having if you're going to help people and you're going to have people try to make hard decisions about things, it's hard enough to try to like turn your life around when you're in a position like that. But if you don't have the resources to do it, it's you know, the compassion on the front end is kind of, it's not as legitimate, or at least not as valuable to that person. So I 100% agree. Like if you can invest in the resources up front, make sure they're there for people, but then have a loving standard to the law on the back end, I feel like that's probably the best way to go about it from what I've thought too.
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
David, we're going to do a lightning round here to cap this off.
Okay.
Before we do though, people who want to follow you, learn more about you, potentially even reach out about your services. You're on Twitter, you're on email, don't have a website, but what's the best way for people to get a hold of you?
Probably just at me on Twitter. I'm pretty on there. The DM thing, unless you're like a blue verified, apparently doesn't work anymore. So just at me on Twitter.
And what's your handle again?
It's Herman Digital, 2 R's and 2 N's. Yeah. That's it, Herman Digital.
Love it. All right, so quick lightning round. Feel free to just give me one or two word or sentence answers here.
Okay.
How would you describe the environment in paid traffic right now?
Complicated.
What's one of your fondest memories from your childhood?
Being with my mom.
And any specific memory with that, or just kind of being with her in general?
Just being with her in general.
If you weren't living in LA, where would you live and why?
If I didn't live in LA?
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, that's a good question. I'm going to say people are going to laugh at this.
I can't wait. This is going to be good.
Honestly, it would probably be Seattle.
Well, it's not so bad. I mean, a little different than LA.
People are always like, you're moving from the sunny to the dreary. I like the cloudy, fogginess. So I love the Pacific Northwest.
Man, what are you doing in LA?
I know. I've lived here for 23 years at this point, so I'm used. It is what it is.
Oh man, you were just full of unexpected answers. This has been fun. Yeah, move from LA to Seattle, run from the police in a Toyota Corolla in 1983 with only
Camry
with only three cylinders firing. Favorite Dodger player of all time?
Mookie Betts.
And why? Why right. is that?
Well, he hit a home run the day my son was born. And I just think he is all around a great athlete on all fronts. And I think he represents the team so well in the community.
Nice. And you may have just answered this, but favorite Dodger moment?
I was at Clayton Kershaw's no-hitter, which actually had the second highest pitching score of all time.
Wow. Pitching score, is that the number of pitches thrown?
No, it's basically the score. They have these like scores that are next to them. So Kerry Wood's 20 strikeouts is the highest pitching score, I believe, of all time. Mm-hmm. And so it's basically like how dominant they were in their start. Got it. Clayton Kershaw would have had a perfect game if it wasn't for Hanley Ramirez dropping the ball. So, yeah.
No bitterness there.
No, not zero.
Yeah, zero. What's your favorite ad platform to work on?
Meta.
Meta.
Yeah. Even though I complain about it all the time, still the best.
Hardest part of your business?
Honestly, it's managing my time.
Yeah, especially
with
kids.
And I get too in the weeds with one brand or go down rabbit holes to try to fix things, and it can take a full day, and then you feel overwhelmed because the next day you have to work on all these other things, and it's just always that. It's always there's one more problem you could solve in a day.
Oh, I feel you, man. How much money in the bank is enough? And you can either answer this with a lump sum, like, hey, if I had 5 million in the bank, 100 million, whatever the number is, 1 million, if I had more money, that'd be great. But if not, I'd be totally content to live a great life with this. So it could be lump sum in the bank. It could also be how much you made per year, just an annuity that came in from some amazing benefactor. Yeah. You had no idea for the rest of your life. So either way you want to skin it, how much money is enough?
8 million.
8 million. Wow. Had you thought about that? You answered very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually thought about it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I felt that it was a number where I don't ever feel like I'm not a materials person. If you can clearly see, I don't no watches, nothing.
You only have two Rolexes on. Like last time, yeah, you had four that Rolexes. I saw you. Yeah.
Yeah. $8 million is enough to be able to live comfortably, and also allows you to do somewhat extravagant things at mm-hmm. times, but it also keeps you humble enough to be able to always remember like who you are and where you came from, and it theoretically shouldn't change you.
Yeah, man, that's one of the better answers I've heard on that question. That's a great way to think about that. How many hours a week do you work?
Oh, if you ask my wife, too much. So since I had a kid, I had to scale back, and I have a policy that I have to be done with work every day at 5.
Mm.
So I usually will typically work straight 7:30 to 5 or 8 to 5. Pretty much nonstop without break.
Nice.
That's my schedule. I used to work way more, but I hired people to help me that have kind of helped me kind of move down a little bit.
What's number one hobby, and you can't say work?
researching World War II battles that no one knows about.
I love it. And then finally, question, who's one of the most interesting people you've met in kind of the online e-commerce space? Let's say DTC, Twitter. It doesn't have to be the most, but one of the people that you just really admire what they put out there and what they're doing and their knowledge in the space.
It's got to be Andrew Foxwell. Andrew is such a great guy. He has been a longtime friend of mine. And I think his Foxwell Founders group of just media buyers has been really... it's been awesome to watch. And I think that he's just an all around, just fantastic guy that absolutely cares about people more than so many and has never once cared about his own, you know, his own brand. It's all about the community. So I definitely have to say him.
That's awesome. Yeah. I've gotten to him a little bit over the last year and agreed, man. Super genuine, great guy. Well, David, this has been super fun. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for willing to talk everything. And yeah, man, are your Dodgers, how are they looking in the playoffs this year?
We have the second best record in MLB.
Ooh.
But if you know anything about the Dodgers, we tend to not do well in the playoffs. So I'm going into it with a little bit of a skepticism as I normally do, but cautiously optimistic that we're going to win the World Series.
Oh, really? Okay, you're going to see, because I'm a Braves guy. I grew up like loving the Braves. I'll spare you the backstory, but Braves are looking pretty good this year. I mean, they have the best record in baseball, I believe, don't they?
They have the best record,
yeah.
But their pitching can be a little bit suspect.
Okay. So I should know this. Braves are NL. Are Dodgers AL? Are they?
Nope, they're NL.
Okay.
NL West.
Okay,
yeah,
so
we'll be playing each other in the NLCS if that's the case.
Oh man, okay, this is good because this means I'm going to have someone I can send some smack talk text to here.
You have the best player in baseball, Robert Acuña Jr., but Mookie is a very good comparison. So
yeah.
You know, we were not supposed to make the playoffs this year. We were supposed to be bad, and here we are. So.
Man, well, I'm glad we kind of, you know, broke the ice a little bit here. So when I send you the scorching texts when you drop, you know, just completely blow it in the ninth inning, that we still are on talking terms.
Yep, yep. I don't wear my Dodger hat anymore because I've ripped it up too many times. So, yeah.
Oh man. Anyway. Well, looking forward to October. And David, so good to connect with you, and thanks for coming
Absolutely.
On. This is a blast.
Absolutely. Good to have you.
Given you've made it to the end of the episode, there's a pretty good chance you're fairly serious about this e-commerce stuff, which is why you should check out the E-Commerce Fuel community. It's a vetted, vibrant community for 7- and 8-figure brand owners. And joining gives you access to a lively discussion forum for experienced founders sharing insights and getting help, access to our library of over 20,000 member reviews on everything from agencies to tech to lawyers to all the things that, you know, founders are making hiring decisions or purchasing decisions on to run their business, and invites to member events throughout the year. So if that sounds interesting, you can apply for membership and learn more at ecommercefuel.com. Big thanks to One-Click Upsell from Zipify Apps. Rapidly increase your AOV by offering targeted, high-converting upsells. You can get started with them at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. And also to Fulfill.io, an ERP designed specifically to streamline complex e-commerce businesses and the highest rated ERP among our community members. Learn more at ecommercefuel.com/fulfill. Thanks so much for listening. Work hard, adventure often, and I'm looking forward to seeing you again next Friday.
This is the ASY Radio Network, live from New York.